Hello, thank you for joining us for today's Pediatric Insight. I'm Bruder Stapleton, Chair of the Child Health Advisory Council, and your host. Our moderator is Ambika Ashraf. Co-leading the discussions are Christine Fink and Peggy Troy. We are also joined by Kenya McNeil-Trice, Lou Bell, Marvin Moxie-Mims, Richard Ruddy, Jim Whalis, and Bob Sowen. And now I'd like to turn it over to Peggy Troy with part two of Wellness Issues Facing Pediatric Leaders.
We're seeing a generational shift from our younger faculty and what they prioritize is their needs, how they think about work-life balance. And it's different than many of us when we were earlier in our careers. So we want to talk a little bit about how institutions have adapted to this generational shift. As I mentioned in the beginning, I've seen three different generations come through in terms of work-life balance, and how are we going to go about that? One of the things, my observation is that some of us that have are definitely in the more senior generation, you know, think that that people that are complaining about too much work or, you know, difficulties with work-life balance, that they're just, you know, they're not committed enough or they're whining or whatever. I see this change in this upcoming generation as real. It's different, and it's something that, as we've all said, we absolutely need to pay attention to, because I think what it's going to do if we don't is it's going to discourage people from going into medicine, pediatric healthcare, and we already are facing the workforce shortages that we see. So I think it's really important that some of us in leadership positions need to really change our thinking. I remember when I first came to Children's many years ago, I had a surgeon tell me, unless you've operated for 30 hours, you're not a real surgeon. Of course, my response is, if you've been operating 30 hours, I don't want you operating on my kid. But we went round and round about that very point, because, you know, if we expect that these younger people coming in, whether we like it or not, are going to work 30 hours in the OR, we're wrong. I think that demands are changing. The sentiment about healthcare among people has definitely changed since COVID. I think the pressures coming from the external forces are much different than they were. You couple that with all the demands of the job, home life, et cetera, it's time to really pay attention to this. And as I mentioned in the beginning, I think that this is an individual issue. It is not one size fits all. So beyond the surveys, wellness coaches, et cetera, I think are a nice asset that many institutions provide, so that they can talk to the individual, especially when you start to realize somebody's, you know, coming late to work, or, you know, is missing important signs and symptoms, et cetera, that we're getting to those people early, because I do think it affects their mental health if we don't.
I think there was an emphasis initially with wellness on sort of resilience and individual things that you would try to do. And I think that's a balance between what the institutional responsibilities are toward the faculty. And I think that's kind of what Peggy was, I mean, many of you have been mentioning that. And one of the things that we did at CHOP was we started tracking who was signing on to Epic after 5 o'clock. And we looked at it by division, and we looked at it by individual. And then we sort of assigned a group to look at that and try to reduce that rate in terms of carrying things home with you, you know, seeing patients all day, getting dinner, getting the kids back, you know, bathed, and then finishing your charts. Another comment is that each division at CHOP have support a group of people to do wellness, and their time is supported, and they are required, or they're expected, to develop divisional wellness activities to try to you know, help gather people together. Some divisions now have huddle days, because there's so much remote work. They've designated days once a week or once every other week as a day when they would want everybody to come in and try to make those connections. So you know, it doesn't all work perfectly, but I think there is an institutional responsibility that I've seen that I think really should be expected and developed related to wellness.
I would just say, I really appreciate the emphasis that's been brought up with regards to going beyond resiliency, and that the climate and interventions really need to be diverse with regards to who you're serving within your faculty and your population. And then what I wanted to add from the perspective, especially if we're talking about burnout and well-being and a transition that I've gone through, even over just even the past 12 to 18 months, is really taking us a step beyond the perspective of well-being and wellness, and really, really emphasizing our health and our morbidity and mortality. And I say that from the perspective of myself having given, I gave a presentation at our PEDS Academic Society's meeting about the impact of being in academic medicine. And despite having submitted the proposal beforehand in February of 2025, there was an original investigation on physician workforce environment and well-being published in JAMA Internal Medicine. It was the first study that looked at vital statistics, population-based registry for physicians. And the results were, I think, just chilling. Despite most healthcare workers having a lower age-adjusted mortality rate, that didn't extend to physicians. Female physicians have higher mortality than male physicians from cancers and lower respiratory disease, and that's regardless of income. That was the same for physicians and health workers who are from Latino settings. This was an incredible cross-sectional study that showed that although physicians and most healthcare workers experienced lower mortality rates compared to the general population, that benefit didn't extend to women or racial or ethnic minorities. That was quite chilling to me to learn that. And when we think about the stressors, not only the stressors of being in our undergraduate situations, our medical schools, our residencies, we talked about like working 30 and 36 hours at a time. You know, our telomeres were getting shortened and our DNA was getting methylated. And it continues when we are, when we have young families having children and working 12 to 18 hours a day at work and then going home and doing the same. So I really do think taking that conversation beyond the perspective of well-being and burnout prevention, and really focusing on health. We're seeing, and I don't know if you all think about those who are in your own settings and maybe colleagues who have left us sooner than you would have anticipated, who have had different health outcomes. What we really are doing to ourselves in these environments of kind of stress and toxicity, and what can institutions do to counteract that? It really is, it's a cumulative effect. And so that's one of the things I really appreciate about this younger generation kind of getting it now. It is a cumulative effect. And I've tried to emphasize that if they don't start taking care of themselves now, some of the stressors that they are experiencing and that's impacting their well-being, mental and physical, can actually impact their morbidity and mortality. When they're at the age of retirement, are they going to even make it to those stages? And I'm really shocked at the number of those in our colleagues who are in health professions and really high stress academic health professions who are not.
And my comment or question has to do with again, this thing about looking on how many hours people are spending charting after hours, what they call the quote unquote pajama time. And so here at Children's, they've started looking at that. And, you know, they'll just, like you say, break it up by division and send it to you. What I struggle with is then what do we do with that information? You know, you can't just say to the person, oh, look, you're doing 4 hours of work after you get home in the evening. Stop doing that. We have to give them some type of resources to address that. And one of the interesting juxtapositions that I saw several months ago was they rolled out new rules in terms of timely chart completion, you know, that 7 days, and then if you get to 30 days, you know, it goes all the way up the chain. And then I think it was the following week that they sent out the physician well-being survey. It's like, do you see the conflict here that you're just sent out these new demands, and then the next week you want us to fill out a wellness survey? So that's where I struggle. It's absolutely, we want to do this, and couple that with what Dr. McNeil Trice just said about impact of all of this. So we're gathering data and not doing anything about it. It reminds me of, you know, as a kidney doc, we have all this data that's been collected over the years, again, looking at minorities and the disproportionate impact, and just a lot of data gathering. We finally have gotten to the point of some studies that are actually trying to now do something. And so I worry the same thing about this wellness piece. What do we do about it? We have all these data, and what do we do?
I really agree with that comment. I think it's one thing to track the data, right? And another to, well, what the heck do you do to support? And I guess that I do think that there's this institutional responsibility to find the solution. What we've done with that data is we've tried to change the templates and the requirements for documentation and make them less, while at the same time, you know, the billing and the communication that we need to do with the electronic health record remains the same. The other that we've done, which I'm really excited about now, is that and AI is contributing to this, is the physicians can just start recording their interactions. We're doing this both on the outpatient side and the inpatient side. And at the end of the visit, it's not just a transcript of what was said during the visit, but it's the note has been written. It's pretty remarkable. We're still being really careful about what those notes say to make sure that they're accurate and they don't need to be edited, but it does save a tremendous amount of time. And I think it's only going to get better as time goes on. But again, I think this, as you were commenting, it's really the institution's responsibility to provide that type of support, to provide that type of expertise, to try to do everything we can to reduce those burdens.
I think the one thing, in addition to what Lou just mentioned, I want to add is the last decade, I think we went from, in Cincinnati, from calling out the people who were not good at finishing their charts as a away from that to saying there must be something they need help with, and individually trying to either use our mentor program, our mental health providers that can be available, or even just because I think that's much better at helping on figure out where to go. And I know that this is not HIPAA protected, but I know that it wasn't that long ago, 15 or so years ago, where someone literally lost their position because they probably had OCD, and when they dictated reports in pathology, they couldn't make it perfect, and it took forever for them to close records. That kind of stuff is really much more about helping the provider as opposed to punishing the provider, and we really need to become masters of that in a better way.
That's a great point. I would also like to share my experience with the AI scribe. So in our health system, we recently started using DAX, which is an AI-driven scribe, which is like a copilot. Initially, I really didn't think I would need it because I had excellent templates and I was like, I'm a pretty good charter. So however, I thought skeptically, I actually opted for this AI scribe. What's fascinating is, as somebody was sharing, many of you shared, By the time it records everything, organize it into HPI, result section, physical exam, assessment and plan. And I also realized I actually talk a lot about our plans to the patients. And when I'm putting it as a template, all of those really doesn't come into the chart or my dictated note or my written notes, but this AI scribe really put all of them in detail. By the time I'm getting out of the room, the note is done. So it has really made a big change, and also in capturing everything I have really done. So I felt, I echo with everybody, the real levers of wellness is institutional, structural. And so I also want to add that beyond efficiency, people also need to feel that the work matters. There has to be recognition, fairness, autonomy. Those are also something that the leadership could do and provide. So that will also to echo that physical well-being and also mental well-being is also so important to prevent inflammatory milieu and also like prevent epigenetic changes. We were just talking about yesterday, most of the childhood neurology tumors, brain tumors are a result of epigenetic changes. And we were like, okay, so their parents could literally transfer all of the, whatever they have suffered during puberty, that would have changed their methylation patterns and that could result in. So we want to protect our physicians and clinicians. So I completely echo with everything that everyone said. And then I don't know if we have time for the last question. So last question is, how do we know any of these wellness efforts are really making a difference? And we know some institutions use surveys, checklists. What would really success of these measures would look like? You, what would a well organization look to you?
I mean, I was thinking about that when the analogy was made to the morbidity and mortality. And if we view this as a nationwide epidemic, we're at the point now where we're throwing lots of different seemingly good ideas at the problem. There needs to be some rigor and study to identify which of these. I mean, I, for example, the scribe, the artificial intelligence scribe may be a great intervention. Will it measurably move the needle? I'm not aware at this point of any good studies to show that it has. This is something begging for a nationwide interventional study.
I agree with Dr. Salin and studying this rigorously with the different methods that people are using to throw at the problem is important. But I also think he highlighted one other thing. You know, the quality of your program will be better because if you have a well faculty that's engaged and feeling that sense of wellness, your morbidity, mortality, your quality metrics will all be, you know, the best to be benchmarked, and your employee retention will be high. And so looking across the board at those institutions that may have really good metrics based on those factors, and then asking them what they're doing for their faculty might be helpful.
I agree with everything, and this may be anecdotal, but perhaps would lend to the effort about rigorous study. I think we, a lot of times institutions will put in interventions that will help individuals do their work in the workplace better. I can tell you as a former chief GME officer and DIO, having trainees across multiple hospitals, the raving, some of the most raving compliments about workplace interventions actually helped when institutions put in resources that helped individuals with their personal life outside of work. And so like a credible example of that was with health systems that put in concierge services that would do your grocery shopping for you, pick up your dry cleaning, take your car to get serviced while you were at work. Like you had something you need to mail, you could just bring it to work. They would mail the package for you. Like they had this they called it a concierge service that would do this for you. And it was like, the trainees were like, it was like they felt like they were in Oz. Like it took this incredible pressure off of individuals that don't work a 9-to-5. We're doing something 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And the joy and the sense of belonging that they gave us from that feedback was incredible. And so it was an institutional investment and their responsibilities outside of work made individuals more present. They felt like they belonged more, and their stress and burnout level declined. So it would be interesting to see even more cross-sectional studies across that nationally if other places do similar interventions. I think we've seen it. We've seen it in Silicon Valley and other places. It'd be interesting to see it in the healthcare setting and academic medicine.
Dr. Ashraf, that also raises a question of this problem is not unique to physicians, and burnout is seemingly epidemic or pandemic in all of healthcare. So I think we've got a lot to learn in a lot of different spaces in the industry.
That is so true. I'm hoping that all of these discussions, even now, we have learned so much about all of these conversations, the adverse consequences of that for health, well-being, longevity, so many things we have learned. I'm hoping all of these reflections, they will ripple forward and we'll gain more insights. It's probably going to be an ongoing continuum of efforts that we have to frequently change our strategies and learn from it and go forward. Thank you all.
Thank you for joining us for today's discussion. If you have a question for our council or have a future topic suggestion, please connect with us at pediatricinsight.com. The Child Health Advisory Council is comprised of a diverse group of emeritus deans, department chairs, division chiefs, and child health executives recognized for their leadership contributions in academic pediatrics and child health. The CHAC's impact is further bolstered by council specialty advisors who are active current national leaders in each of the subspecialties in pediatrics. Collectively, the 30-plus members of the CHAC bring unmatched wisdom and experience to career physicians' executive search and leadership development endeavors for its clients.